Chapter 9 of Walter Youngquist's book, Geodestinies. The Oil Interval. The term interval is intentionally used here in place of era, or some other longer time term, because the time of significant production and use of oil will be but a brief, bright blip in human history, never to be repeated. During this time, oil has rapidly changed the world in myriad ways never even faintly imagined by the few gathered around the Drake Well near Titusville in northwestern Pennsylvania in 1859, who saw the liquid found by drilling to 59.5 feet. Long before the Drake Well, oil was known in many regions, most notably in the Baku region of the Black Sea. Much earlier, Egyptians used oil to embalm their dead, and it is likely that the basket floating the baby Moses on the Nile was caulked with asphalt, used even then as a building material. Since inception, the oil industry has grown into a complex, constantly changing enterprise, essential to the industrial activities of nearly all economies, and greatly influencing the daily lives of many people. It fuels all air transport and nearly all ground and sea transport. The industry also provides chemicals, building materials, medicines, fertilizers, and countless other products. Beginnings of modern oil industry. The beginning of the modern oil industry is generally identified with Drake's discovery that oil could be obtained by drilling. The technique soon expanded to other areas in the United States and then abroad. Oil exploration was greatly enhanced by technology, notably by the use of the reflective seismograph invented in the United States in 1921. Oil has been discovered in more than 80 countries, but only a few countries have significant deposits. The historical growth of world oil production is shown in Table 9.1. U.S. dominant for a time. In 1920, the United States produced 80% of the world's oil. In 1950, it still produced more than half and was completely self-sufficient in oil. This allowed the United States to become a military and industrial power while improving the economy and lifestyle of its citizens. These effects spread to other countries with their discovery and exploration of oil. Peak of U.S. production. The mid-20th century United States oil production dominance was short-lived. In 1956, M. King Hubbert predicted that the U.S. oil production would peak in 1970. His work generally was dismissed or ignored because in 1956, U.S. production was still rising and world dominant. However, Hubbert's prediction proved to be remarkably correct, as shown in the plot by Hirsch in Figure 9.2. Even before 1970, the United States could not produce enough for its own growing demands and had become a net oil importer. It was never again able to domestically produce oil equal to its demand. Unrecognized then, this turning point marked the beginning of the time when the economic destiny of the United States gradually passed into foreign hands. A clear and sad example of such power was the 2007 visit of a U.S. president to Saudi Arabia to ask the king to produce more oil to reduce the price of gasoline for U.S. consumers. Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, ANSWR, and U.S. oil supply. It is important to understand the realistic potential of getting oil from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, ANWR, for solving our oil supply problem. ANSWR's oil potential has been thoroughly studied and much debated, including a 320-page U.S. Geological Survey report with 5 maps prepared by Byrd and Magoon in 1987. My later conversations with co-author Les Magoon and one of my former students affirmed the limited oil realities of this region. Unlike Prudhoe Bay, 70 miles to the west, the small area in ANWR that is expected to be productive consists of a number of small structures and numerous faults. Total reserves are estimated to be in the range of 6 to 11 billion barrels produced over a period of about 20 years. ANSWR, at best, can be only a modest help in the U.S. oil supply problem. A lot of the a lot of the concern about potential environmental impacts from oil activities on Anwar is unfounded. Of the more than 17 million acres in Anwar, only a small fraction is potentially oil productive, and of this coastal plain area, it is estimated that only about 2,000 acres would be involved using directional drilling from a relatively few sites. Also, the experience at Prudhoe Bay shows that the original caribou herd of 3,000 has actually increased to more than 15,000. The caribou roam freely under the pipeline and over the oil field. Drilling in Anwar, like Prudhoe Bay, is unlikely to harm the caribou. An argument favoring Anwar production, important to the Prudhoe Bay's future, is that Anwar would provide additional oil for the 800-mile Alaska pipeline that would justify its continued use for some time to come. Anwar oil would help more Prudhoe oil to be recovered. However, Anwar would itself do little to ease United States oil supply problems, and the commonly used argument that Anwar could provide only a year or so of oil to the U.S. is not valid because the oil cannot be produced in a year or so, but only over about 20 years, with annual totals in modest amounts. The impact of the use of oil. The impact of oil has been immense in world history. The oil industry has become the largest single commercial enterprise in the world. It uses more technology than any other enterprise, from exploration to refining to its thousands of end uses. Power source comparisons. Pimentel and Pimentel, 2008, make useful comparisons of the power inputs in agriculture, comparing the power of one person to other sources. One person is about 1/10 horsepower. That means one horse can do the work of 10 people in an hour. The use of animal power greatly improved agricultural production beyond the potential of using only human labor. But an even greater leap was achieved with energy from oil derivatives, chiefly gasoline. These authors point out that even with an energy conversion efficiency of about 20%, by using gasoline to power farm machinery, 1 gallon of gasoline can produce more power than a horse working at maximum capacity for 10 hours. Further, 1 gallon of gasoline produces the equivalent of almost 3 weeks of human work at the rate of 0.1 horsepower, or 0.075 kilowatts, for 40 hours a week. In another comparison, they estimate that a gallon of gasoline in an engine will generate the same work as 97 man-hours of labor. Andrew Nikifork, in 2008, cites David Hughes's Geological Survey of Canada calculation, quote, "A barrel of oil, as analyst David Hughes often reminds me, equals 8.6 years of human labor." A barrel of oil equals 8.6 years of human labor. A human lifespan could produce about 3 barrels of oil equivalent energy, unquote. Using another measure of what oil does for us, Campbell and others estimate that current world consumption of oil is the energy equivalent of the work of 22 billion slaves 24 hours a day. Most users of oil today have very little appreciation of the scale of the contribution oil makes to our everyday lives. Replacing this versatile, energy-dense, easily transported form of energy by any alternatives is likely to be much more of a problem than generally thought. Advances in agriculture owe almost everything to oil. Oil has lifted the backbreaking dawn-to-dusk burdens of farming by what Stanton in 2007 called the 40-to-1 factor. By this, he means that the use of oil in agriculture has reduced the need for human labor by a factor of 40-to-1. In some cases, such as powering combines or tractors, the factor may well be in the vicinity of 100-to-1. Probably the most important effect of using oil has been in the production of food. Oil-powered mechanized agriculture now allows one person to plow, plant, cultivate, fertilize, and harvest possibly 1,000 or more acres of land. Petroleum, oil, and gas further benefits agriculture in the form of fertilizers and pesticides derived from it. The most important ammonia-based fertilizer used in modern agriculture is made by means of natural gas. Oil-powered tractors pull tanks with liquid fertilizer sprayers over farmland to enhance its productivity well beyond what the land could otherwise achieve. This creates what have been called ghost acres, extra production, as if from additional acres, that exist only because of the beneficial effects of fertilizer. When oil is no longer available for agriculture, finding substitutes for all its uses as labor, chemicals, and fuel will be an enormous challenge. Will agriculture return to intensive hand labor as in the past? Food production is surely the most important of all human activities. Oil has greatly expanded the food supply and led to a huge rise in population. The plot of the curve of the rise in oil consumption is closely paralleled with that of population growth. As oil declines, will the curves continue to parallel on the downside, or will population growth continue? Can even our current population be supported without the aid of oil and agriculture? Campbell has graphically expressed this view in the on the relationship of oil consumption population growth in Figure 9.3. Ferguson has specifically addressed this problem, and his conclusions are similar to those of Campbell's. Quote, "The end of fossil fuels or the demise of cheap energy will change nearly all aspects of our lives, but none is as fundamental as the food supplies needed to keep the human population alive. Any farmer who continues with the practice of high, costly energy input to agriculture will not be able to compete in price with those who decide to forego the high inputs and settle for a lower output. The energy transition, which people talk about so blithely, is likely to involve a total change of lifestyle with a much smaller population, is almost beyond dispute when account is taken of matters such as those investigated above." Unquote. Many other industries besides agriculture are based on oil. These include the tourist industry with motels, hotels, resorts, and cruises all tied to transportation, the airline and automobile industries, and the huge petrochemical industry producing not only agricultural chemicals, but literally thousands of household products in everyday use. These include tires, cosmetics, paints, clothes, medicines, and roofing materials. Oil-based plastics are ubiquitous in every household, yet few people realize oil's many and varied roles in their lives. From a Union Oil Company, now part of Chevron, information leaflet, Table 9.2 shows what might be produced from a typical barrel of oil. How can this great variety of products and thousands of others be produced from wind, solar, or nuclear sources? Oil is not simply an energy source. 40% of oil goes into other uses. There are simply no known substitutes for oil in all these uses. Finding more energy to replace oil is the current focus, but that is by no means the complete answer to the decline of oil production. It will affect us in many ways beyond its use as an energy source. One of the most fundamental uses of oil, rarely noticed by most people, is literally beneath our feet. Asphalt comes from the bottoms of oil refining operations. It is the residue left after the lighter parts of oil are distilled off. Nearly all of our worldwide ground transport infrastructure depends on millions of miles of asphalt pavement. Try paving roads with ethanol, biodiesel, or hydrogen. Asphalt's availability will decline as oil production declines, and existing pavement will gradually deteriorate. The pothole plague, now common in many areas, is only the beginning of greater problems. Rising costs and asphalt shortages are already delaying maintenance of existing roads. Asphalt paves 94% of the roads in the United States. This is a total of about 4 million miles, and is the basis of our entire ground transport infrastructure, except for railroads. Its price is closely related to that of oil, and it provides ease of mobility in the industrial world and for some of the less developed world, regardless of what may power the vehicles that use it. The U.S. Transcontinental Freeway System, built during the Eisenhower administration in the 1950s, is almost entirely asphalt. When that goes, as a South Dakota road engineer told me, there are a lot of dusty and muddy roads ahead. Whatever personal and freight transport may be developed by the automobiles and truck industry, if there are no paved roads, gravel and seasonally muddy roads prevail and will become large and inconvenient problems. Most of us do not consider how important lowly asphalt is to our daily lives in just getting to the supermarket or having trucks deliver products that stock those shelves. Origin of oil. Accumulation of organic materials in basins. Through its geologic occurrence and chemical evidence, it is clear that oil is derived from organic material. Hunt, 1996, probably is the most widely experienced researcher in petroleum geochemistry, writes, quote, "The whole argument of biological origin of oil was settled with the discovery of optically active molecules deep in the source rocks. It is impossible to make optical activity from inorganic sources. Some gas may be inorganic, but not oil. Some people still continue to believe and promote the idea that oil somehow originates deep within the earth from inorganic sources, like Connie Barlow and Tommy Gold." Hunt's statement should be put an end to these erroneous and unsupported arguments. This organic material accumulates with other sediments in structural basins in the earth, both within continents invaded by the ocean and along the continental margins. The central deep ocean regions do not have any significant accumulation of sediments and therefore have no oil. Depending on how one defines the limits of a basin, there are about 600 sediment basins worldwide, most of which have been explored to a greater or lesser extent. Only about 200 of them are oil productive, and of these, only a few very few basins contain the huge oil fields in which most oil is located. The earth has been fully explored, and the larger and most productive oil basins have been drilled and are now in production. The organic material from which oil is derived is mostly plants, with algae in many areas being the predominant source material. Campbell, in 2005A, notes that, quote, "Isotopic examinations show that oil was derived from algae," unquote. Algae in ancient oceans furnished the basis for industrialization and for dramatically different lifestyles from previous centuries. The course of human history has been greatly influenced by simple algae transforming into oil. Another source of oil include the buried mangrove swamps found in offshore Angola and in the southeastern Asia. Plankton, both floating animal and plant forms, are also important. The unicellular animals, foraminifera, may be a major source of the oil found in the Shirt Basin of Libya. Most oil is formed in marine environments. A few commercial deposits have been discovered in deeply buried organic materials, mostly algae, in lake basins in Nevada and China. Freshwater algae produce quite a different type of oil than does marine algae. There are about 30,000 species of algae. Many kinds of oil. The kind of source material, how long the organic material and then the oil are cooked, and at what temperatures, how deeply it is buried, pressure, and for how long, determine the many different kinds and qualities of oil. The Oil and Gas Journal lists prices for 14 different oils produced just in the United States. Classifying oil. Oil can be classified in various ways, but a common way is to designate it as either sweet, less than 5% sulfur, or sour, 5% or more sulfur. It is also classified by how light, thin, or heavy, thick it is. This is expressed by a gravity figure, inverse in numbers to how thick or thin the oil is. A 40 gravity oil is light, and a 20 gravity oil is heavy. At around 52 gravity, the oil becomes gas. Oil in the Maracaibo Basin of Venezuela is heavy crude, about 20 gravity. It is so heavy that the oil storage tanks are not painted silver to reflect the sun's heat, but black to absorb heat and keep the oil thin for the pipeline movement. The benchmark oil in the United States is West Texas Intermediate, WTI. A good grade oil. Its price is quoted every day. In 2009, Saudi Arabia switched, and Kuwait is considered switching to using the Angus Sour Crude Index. This is based on the fact that more oil supplies now come from medium sour crude oil than from West Texas, from which the initial crude oil index was derived. Saudi Arabia oil exported to the United States is lower quality than the West Texas crude, containing enough sulfur to be classed as sour. Venezuela and other exporters to the U.S. of sour crude oil may also eventually use this index. In Europe, the benchmark oil quoted is the North Sea Brent, which is a slightly lower quality oil than WTI, and therefore usually sells for slightly less. Refineries prefer to refine light oils with a low sulfur content, since they can be made more easily. They can be more easily made into higher value end products. Worldwide, these oils have generally been produced first, so remaining oil is heavier and lower quality crude. Refineries are gradually having to adjust to this new reality with related higher refining costs. The oil window. Once deposited in an anaerobic, oxygen-lacking environment through which the organic material is preserved, it must be buried deeply enough so that the geothermal temperature gradient of the Earth is such that that a temperature of about 156 degrees Fahrenheit is reached, the minimum temperature for the start of the oil window. Together with the pressure from the overlaying sediments, the organic material is slowly cooked to produce oil. And then he has figure 9.4. Sediment containing oil is commonly an organic-rich black shale. After the organic material has been cooked into oil, it has to migrate into a permeable and pore-sealed reservoir from which it can be economically extracted. Role of structure and stratigraphic traps. To prevent the oil from continuing to migrate and disperse, a trap is needed. Early in oil exploration, it was discovered that anticlines, upfolds in the Earth's crust, were excellent oil traps. If they were found at the surface by mapping or in subsurface by the seismograph, these obvious exploration targets were drilled first, as many California oil fields were. In the Persian Gulf region, it appears that the collision of the continental masses resulted in many anticlinal traps for an echelon of elongate oil fields, most famous of which is the gigantic Ghawar oil field. This is the world's largest oil field and is the most important in Saudi Arabia and therefore of world importance. Discovered in 1948, it still produces more than half of Saudi oil. Another form of trap is the stratigraphic, such as the sandbar buried in shale with both ends terminating in an impervious shale. This sort of trap, lying at some depth, usually has no surface expression as many anticlines do. Therefore, they are more difficult to find than structural traps, which have both anticlines and faults. However, detailed and improved seismography technology can find these traps. Earlier, they would have been found simply by random drilling, as the Great East Texas oil field was. A classic buried stratigraphic sandbar trap, it was discovered in 1930 and is second only to Prudhoe Bay, the largest field ever discovered in North America. In the Nigerian Delta, there are stratigraphic traps that are hard to detect, but ExxonMobil has developed an indicator of significant hydrocarbon subsurface accumulations they call R3M, which is apparently quite successful. Importance of a cap. The oil reservoir also has to be capped by impermeable strata to prevent the oil from leaking out. Many a highly prospective reservoir has been drilled only to discover that the oil had leaked out. This was the case with one of the most expensive wells ever drilled, the Muklak No. 1, drilled offshore Alaska by Soho Oil Company. The great oil deposits of the Middle East owe their survival largely to the presence of very effective reservoir caps. Amount of ancient plant material for 1 gallon of gasoline. Using plant material as the theoretical originating material, Jeffrey Dukes, biologist and biochemist at the University of Massachusetts, has calculated that it takes approximately 190,000 pounds, 95 tons, of prehistoric plant material to yield 13.2 pounds of crude oil, including 6.2 pounds, 1 gallon of gasoline. Thus, the production of just this 1 gallon of gasoline represents a huge distilling and concentration operation, which nature accomplishes for us in the earth. Have you ever considered the amount of ancient algae and the amount of heat energy and related cooking time it took you to bring that gallon of gasoline? To sum it all up for its shareholders, the LAMP, version 88, number 1, 2006, ExxonMobil wrote, quote, "Here is the recipe for oil. Gather large amounts of organic matter in a sedimentary basin, compress under enormous weight, and cook it at moderate temperatures for millions of years. Seal it in a reservoir until ready to use," unquote. To produce, preserve, and accumulate oil in large commercial quantities has taken a remarkable series and precise succession of geologic events, which have occurred in only a few places in the Earth during relatively few times in Earth's history. It is a limited resource and one that controls the destinies of many nations. But this is only a temporary circumstance because oil supplies are finite, and the world will have to move beyond oil in this century. The big question is, to what? Just drill deeper? To prolong the oil interval we now enjoy, it is sometimes suggested that we should simply drill deeper for more oil. This might be true in a limited number of places, but if it was possible and feasible, oil exploration companies would already have done so. At 10,000 feet, and in some regions such as Kansas, even shallower, the drill bit would hit either igneous or metamorphic rock, so-called basement rocks, where oil is not generated and does not exist. Oil is limited vertically by the depth needed for the oil window temperature to be reached. But oil occurrence also is limited at greater depth. In most of the Earth, below 15,000 to 16,000 feet, the geothermal gradient, increase in temperature with depth, is such that at these depths and related temperatures, oil is not suitable and breaks into the simplest hydrocarbon molecule, methane. How deep oil occurs also depends on the type of source material and how long the organic material has been buried. In a few places, thick beds of salt alter the geothermal gradient, and oil can survive at greater depths, as in the Campos and Santos basins offshore Brazil. But there is an ultimate depth below which no oil, only natural gas, occurs, so drilling deeper is generally not the answer to finding more oil. Who has the oil? Changes by discoveries, depletion, and price. Who has the oil has changed considerably over the years. Discoveries in some countries and the depletion of oil deposits in others has altered the picture. This is illustrated in Table 9.3 in just 27 years between 1974 and 2003. Another factor is the price of oil. When oil was $3 a barrel, as it was for a long time, Canada was credited with having only a small amount. Higher prices for oil made the oil in the vast Athabasca deposits economically competitive with conventional oil, giving Canada, by some estimates, reserves nearly as large as those of Saudi Arabia. Who has the oil? And the concepts of resources and reserves. With oil currently the major source of world energy, the important question is who has it? The Middle East Gulf nations are estimated to have something over 60% of world oil reserves, and Saudi Arabia alone has 25% of the world's total oil reserves. The terms reserves and resources are sometimes confused. The term reserves, applied to any natural resource, including oil, means the amount that can be produced with existing technology at current prices. Obviously, reserves may vary in size depending on the development of new and more efficient technology and current prices. This has certainly been seen in the case of both oil and natural gas, and in metals, with wide fluctuations in the price of gold and silver and the size of reserves of these commodities changing. Resources are the total amount of any commodity in the earth, only a portion of which can at any time be correctly be termed reserves. Also, the term oil in place is sometimes used in the oil industry to describe the resource. Press reports and others may make the error of assuming oil in place, resource, is a reserve. An example is the oil in the Caspian region, where the oil in place initially was estimated at 200 billion barrels, and the press reported an oil discovery, quote, nearly equal to the reserves of Saudi Arabia, unquote. However, when geologists and engineers later reevaluated the Caspian reserves, they arrived at a figure of about 40 billion barrels. Big difference from 200. The Athabasca oil sands deposit are another example. Estimates are estimated to have as much as 2 trillion barrels of oil in place. The economically recoverable oil reserves are estimated to be in the vicinity of 175 billion barrels. With the steep drop in the price of oil during the 2007-2008 from more than $147 a barrel to briefly less than $40, part of the Athabasca oil reserves were relegated back to the status of resources. Development of some oil sand projects were put on hold to a time when the price of oil again rises, and some of the resources revert to reserve status. Political reserves. Studies of world oil reserves, especially one by French geologist Jean Laher, 1995, indicate that in many countries, the reserves are political to some degree rather than actual. It is notable that reserves estimates by some countries have not changed in many years. For example, Kuwait reported the same reserves from 1991 to 2002, whereas others changed dramatically in just 1 year. Oil reserve estimates are not independently audited, and the figures published annually in the Oil and Gas Journal are simply those provided by the individual countries and may not be correct. Political reserves may serve a couple of purposes. They may be inflated because the people in charge of oil field operations in a country are prone to report to the politicians in charge that they have found more oil that year than they have produced, so reserves happily go up. Workers continue to keep their jobs and may even get a raise. Also, in OPEC countries, agreed-upon production quotas are based on reserves. Some countries in OPEC can increase their production to increase their oil export by inflating the reserves. The end result is that the unaudited reserve figures are suspect. In contrast, in most industrialized countries, including the United States and Canada, reserves are independently audited and are probably fairly accurate. Even in these cases, how much oil can really be economically recovered from a well or field can never actually be known until the well is plugged or the field abandoned. Unaudited reserves. Reserve figures from unaudited countries probably indicate the amount of oil each country has relative to others that can be economically recovered. On this basis, with the caveat that reserve oil estimates are much more reliable from independently audited countries than others, the following table, 9.4, indicates the probable relative oil positions of selected countries. Table 9.4 makes the importance of Saudi Arabian oil reserves to the world economy clear. But there has been little transparency about the validity of these reserves. However, Matthew Simmons, after being on the group tour conducted by Saudi officials in their oil facilities and learning very little, returned to the United States and made a shrewd discovery. American petroleum engineers who had worked in Saudi Arabia and returned to the States had published a number of papers about the Saudi oil fields. Simmons laboriously examined some 200 of these articles, putting his findings and conclusion in the book Twilight in the Desert, The Coming Saudi Oil Shock and the World Economy, 2005. Simmons concluded that the estimates put out by the Saudis were exaggerated. This was not well received by the Saudi government, which once claimed it could produce, quote, 15 million barrels a day for 50 years, unquote. Since Simmons' book, the Saudi claim has not been repeated. At a professional gathering, a Saudi oil official informally told me that he thought Saudi oil production might level off at 12.5 million barrels a day. This figure has appeared in various publications and seems likely to be correct. In 2005, Colin Campbell also published an estimate of Saudi and other countries' oil reserves and came to the same conclusions as Simmons, that Saudi estimates Estimated reserves were exaggerated. Even if one applies reasonably estimated reductions in unaudited oil reserve estimates, the Middle East still has the major share of world oil reserves, Table 9-4, and will be a dominant factor in the economic future of many nations for decades to come. The role of OPEC. The move to form the Organization of Oil Exporting Countries was made by Venezuela in 1969. The goal was to break the long-held control over the price of oil by the investor-owned oil companies. Membership in OPEC changes from time to time, but it currently has 12 members. They are Algeria, Angola, Ecuador, Kuwait, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Nigeria, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Venezuela. Indonesia, now a net oil importer, dropped out in 2008. Periodically, members meet and vote to set the size of their combined oil production and are assigned oil production quotas based on their claimed reserves. Since most OPEC countries like to maximize their oil production to raise their oil export incomes, there is a tendency to cheat on production quotas. Saudi Arabia has probably been the most diligent in observing its quota. Because it overshadows all other OPEC members in production, it is the swing producer. Theoretically, Saudi Arabia can bring into line any OPEC member not adhering to its quota by increasing its own production and thus reducing the OPEC price. But this has rarely, if ever, been done. Saudi Arabia simply threatens to do this. The individual OPEC country production quotas have been only loosely enforced. OPEC likes to promote the idea that it is concerned about the economic health of the oil-consuming countries and therefore might increase its production to reduce excessive prices. But when world oil price exceeded $145 a barrel in 2008, OPEC countries were not dismayed. However, when oil dropped below $60 a barrel and briefly below $40 abruptly that same year, OPEC called an emergency meeting. Saudi Arabia announced a cut in production of 1.5 million barrels a day to try to stabilize, if not raise the price. OPEC intervenes through production when it suits their interests. When demand exceeds supply and market forces raise oil prices, OPEC is likely to let prices take their inevitable climb. It may be that Saudi Arabia's excess oil production capacity is unavailable. The kingdom has increasing domestic demand and may reserve some of its remaining oil for the long term. Therefore, oil price will be based strictly on supply and demand, a totally free market. Oil exporters. Gradually, as oil fields decline in some countries, they may grow in number and size in others. The long-term trend is almost certainly a decline in the amount of oil worldwide available for export. The Persian Gulf countries will probably be the last countries with oil available for export. The United Kingdom has become a net importer of oil and gas, and its share of the North Sea oil production has passed its peak and is experiencing a fairly rapid decline. Because oil is essential to its economy, the UK has lost control of its economic destiny. Indeed, all countries who depend on oil to support their economies and who lack sufficient oil to meet their domestic needs have ceded their future to those who have oil. Most other European countries have been oil importers for years. The United States imports the largest quantity of oil, 11 to 12 million barrels a day, including refined products. This represents about 60% of total U.S. oil consumption. In a belated response to the first oil embargo crisis of 1973, the U.S. established the U.S. Department of Energy in 1977 with the stated purpose, quote, to lessen our dependence on foreign oil, unquote. Now, with 16,000 federal employees and approximately 100,000 contract employees and an annual budget of $24 billion, the U.S. imports twice as much oil as it did when the agency was established. U.S. oil imports now come mainly from six countries. Surprisingly to many people, the largest supplier is Canada. China is the second largest oil importing country at 6.7 million barrels a day. This amount is certain to grow as China makes a major effort to motorize more of its citizens. Japan is third at 5.5 million barrels a day. Other Asian nations and India are increasing their demand for oil. This can only mean continuing higher prices. Well, maybe not, given 2016. Canada's declining conventional oil production is being replaced in part by oil from oil sands production, oil sands extraction. So it may continue for some time to be the chief oil exporter to the United States. However, oil sands extraction, as detailed in Chapter 15, will be constrained by limited energy and water supplies and may only reach 4 million barrels by 2030. If this happens, Canada may maintain its export volumes for some time to come, but eventually Canada's own population growth, combined with increased industrial activity and the decline in conventional oil production, will reduce the amount of oil available for export. Mexico, the second largest source of U.S. oil import supplies, is experiencing sharp production declines in its Cantarell oil field, which is equivalent in importance to Mexico as the huge Ghawar field is to Saudi Arabia. The rate of decline is above 15%, 31% in 2008, and estimates are now that without major changes in its national policy of excluding foreign investment, Mexico may become a net oil importer within the next decade. A loss of imported Mexican oil would put Venezuela second and Saudi Arabia third as the largest oil sources of oil imports to the United States. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has been an outspoken critic of the United States. China views this as an opportunity to invest in Venezuelan oil operations, arranging to have Venezuelan oil supplied to refineries built by China, both in Venezuela and in China. U.S. oil imports from Venezuela seem likely to be in an increasingly perilous position. Addicted to oil. It is frequently stated by politicians in particular that the United States is addicted to oil. Campaigns promise to break that oil addiction, at least as far as imported oil is concerned. That is unlikely to happen unless there is no longer oil for the United States to import. Addiction to oil is a mutual problem. Addiction to oil, quote-unquote, is a problem for many oil-exporting countries as well. Almost all government revenues in Kuwait, Libya, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia come from the sale of oil. Other countries such as Algeria, Angola, Ecuador, Iran, Nigeria, and Venezuela are heavily dependent on oil for their revenues. In Russia, 40% of the government income is from oil. When U.S. money stops pouring into Iraq, that country will also be largely dependent on the sale of oil to support its government. An oil price of $95 a barrel is required to finance President Chavez's social spending programs, widespread welfare, and military equipment purchases. Iran's current budget is based on $80 a barrel of oil. Saudi Arabia, greatly dependent on its export of crude and upgraded oil products, needs an oil price of $55 a barrel to balance its government budget. Russia needs $70 a barrel of oil. So, addicted to oil works both ways, and when oil ceases to flow abundantly, those addicted as producers as well as users will suffer. Actually, the United States is less addicted to oil than is generally believed. It has substantial coal reserves and some hydropower, and is still a major oil producer, third among nations. And it has a fertile soil and fresh water, neither of which are abundant in the Gulf countries, except to a limited extent in Iran. The desert sands of Qatar, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates in Saudi Arabia do not support much agriculture for their populations, which is a very serious problem. Discoveries versus production. As shown in Figure 9.5, since 1981, more oil has been produced or extracted annually than has been found. This trend continues, and the disparity between production and discovery increases. Recent statistics show that the world consumes 31 billion barrels a year, but combined discoveries and drilling in and around already discovered fields yields only $14 billion. New discoveries, the lifeblood and the future of the oil industry, are only 7 billion barrels. This means that we are consuming more than four times the amount of oil that we are discovering. This is not a sustainable trend. The peak of world oil discovery for volume of oil was approximately 1965. figure 9-6. Since then, there has been a decided downtrend in discoveries, and discoveries have tended to get smaller and smaller. The reason for this is that large oil fields, because they are large, are usually discovered early in exploring a basin. As drilling proceeds, less and less oil is found per foot drilled. French geologist Jean Laher, putting this trend in graphic form, calls it the creaming curve. Campbell shows this in figure 9-7. Campbell has also studied the results of drilling in the Persian Gulf region and finds those nations are not immune to the same problem of finding less oil per foot drilled over time. A spurt in worldwide drilling from 1976 to 1983, figure 9-8, did not find a commensurate amount of oil, illustrating that large, easy-to-find oil accumulations have already been discovered. What remains required more drilling. Thus, each barrel of oil discovered is more expensive than it was in earlier years. Figure 9-8. The classic theoretical curves of discovery and production are shown in figure 9-9. The production curve here mirrors the discovery curve. In actual experience, both curves are less symmetrical since discoveries depend on where exploration is conducted and how successful it is. Both discovery and production are influenced by market conditions as well as the political environments of individual countries. However, taking the broad view, these classic curves reveal that discoveries rise to a peak and then decline. Production follows the same pattern. Both ultimately end at zero. Although in the case of production slash extraction, there may be a long tail in its curve toward the end because oil prices may rise very rapidly, bringing marginal production on stream. The depletion problem. Like the proverbial alligator continuing to eat up a leg, depletion of oil fields continues everywhere. When primary, flowing and pumping, and secondary recovery, water flood and gas injection, have been used, sometimes a third method of oil production is used, termed enhanced oil recovery, EOR. These methods include injection of steam or chemicals to improve oil flow to wells from the reservoir. Costs range from $1.50 to $30 for each additional barrel recovered, but this technology has only been moderately successful and does not add much to the total oil being produced. The worldwide oil depletion rate has been estimated at between 4 and 9% annually. A figure of 6.7% seems to be the current situation. The huge investments needed to slow this decline are not forthcoming. Many countries spend their oil income mostly on domestic needs and cannot or do not invest in oil production enhancement projects on which little immediate return is available. Mexico, for example, has underfunded its oil infrastructure to pay for social programs. Campbell has graphed the depletion problem as it applies both to a basin and to a country. Figure 9-10. Oil depletion protocol. This is a method of managing the depletion of a non-renewable resource to make the effects of depletion less disruptive, gradually integrating into a new economy. It was suggested using a different name by Bartlett in 1986, and later independently proposed and described in detail by Campbell, 2005. Heinberg, in 2006, has expanded on the topic of oil depletion protocol to a book length. The concept is simple. Each importing country shall reduce its imports to match the current world depletion rate, deducting any indigenous production, unquote. So that's the concept, is each importing country shall reduce its imports to match the current world depletion rate, deducting any indigenous production. This concept has considerable logic and merit, but little political appeal, as is true of many needed changes. It therefore has been ignored by policymakers, but its time may yet still come. Daily oil well production. There's a big difference in what oil wells from different quality reservoirs can produce each day. Usually, highly productive wells are choked down, that is, the diameter of the valve for controlling oil flow is reduced to prevent injury to the reservoir by unnecessary water invasion or high gas flow. The water and gas pressure should be used for aiding oil production, but in daily production, there remains great differences. From approximately 1,400 wells, Saudi Arabia can produce 9 million barrels a day, whereas in the United States, more than 500,000 wells now produce only about 5.4 million barrels a day. Well, that's interesting. From approximately 1,400 wells, Saudi Arabia can produce 9 million barrels a day, whereas in the United States, more than 500,000 wells now produce only about 5.4 million barrels a day. The average well in the United States produces 10.1 barrels per day, and more than half of the more than 500,000 wells are stripper wells, wells producing less than 10 barrels a day. In the state of Pennsylvania, where the modern oil industry is credited with getting its start, the average well now produces 2 barrels a day, which is an average of intermittent pumping over a period of time. Table 9.6 shows the daily oil production per well in selected countries by region. In 2010, the United States had 531,951 wells, from which it produced just 73% of the amount of oil produced by Saudi Arabia from only 2,889 wells. The difference is due to the average quality of reservoirs in the two respective countries. Allah favored Saudi Arabia in that matter also. Table 9.6. World peak oil. Peak oil, conventional oil only, excludes shale oil and oil sands oil, refers to the time when world oil production reaches its peak and then begins its inevitable decline, with perhaps a few brief reversals in the decline curve. In 1956, geophysicist M. King Hubbert made a remarkably accurate study that predicted U.S. oil production would peak in 1970. When he made his prediction, the United States produced more than half the world's oil. Hubbert was scoffed at. But when his prediction proved uncannily accurate, others were encouraged to broadly apply Hubbert's production curve, as it came to be known, to the matter. For various reasons, that curve is not a very good fit, and others have been used. Since oil is intertwined in our economies and lifestyles in countless ways, the date of the peak and decline of world oil production is exceedingly important. Over the years, there have been many estimates and many studies of peak oil. The Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, ASPO, was credited with many of its member geologists and engineers continuing to explore approaches to understanding world peak oil production. Study results. Despite numerous studies, the date of peak oil remains subject to wide division of opinion. Technological advances in the recovery of oil from existing fields have mitigated the overall annual world field decline of about 5 to 6%. The ability of industry to make discoveries offshore in ocean depths of up to 10,000 feet has added new oil reserves. Offshore West Africa and Brazil are notable sites, and discoveries continue with a recent new discovery discovered offshore Ghana. Rising world demand resulted in higher oil prices has made the economic recovery of more oil possible. In 1956, M. King Hubbert predicted world oil would peak in 2000. The technology and knowledge of oil basins then was very limited compared to that of today, excusing Hubbard's erroneous prediction. Later studies tended to settle on the years 2005-2007 for world peak oil production. In 2010, the International Energy Agency stated that production of conventional crude peaked in 2006. Duncan and Youngquist, 1999, put it at 2007. A recent study, Towler, 2011, cited higher oil prices, advanced technologies, and regions yet to be explored as prime factors, stating that world peak oil production is still a few years away, with the peak unlikely to occur before 2018 and possibly later. In yet another view, the U.S. Department of Defense Joint Operation Command, in a 2011 report, stated that an oil shortfall poses a serious challenge to military preparedness and that world oil production could begin to decline by 2012. Bearing on the matter of peak oil world production is a study published in 2012 by Swedish physicist Kjell Ekle, Peaking of Peak Oil, where peaking, P-E-E-K, peaking at peak oil, wherein he examines what unconventional oil sources might do for future oil production. Noting the decline of conventional oil, world oil production at the annual rate of about 4 million barrels a day, he estimates that the incremental addition to world oil supplies from unconventional oil will ultimately be about 8 million barrels a day. This would be just 2 years offset to the decline of conventional oil and does not provide for either gain, for any gain in world production. He also notes that whereas oil demand is currently either flat or declining in most OPEC or OECD countries, total world oil demand is increasing. Further complications are both the high cost and time lag involved from the difficulties in bringing the additional 8 million barrels a day of unconventional oil on stream, as compared with the relatively rapid development of conventional oil sources. The peak of oil production from all sources may be essentially agreed upon us, 2012, as the previously cited U.S. Department of Defense study has suggested. Higher oil prices seem a certainty. What seems clear is that the era of cheap oil has passed. The easy oil has been discovered and developed, and the oil industry has moved into far more expensive frontier areas, such as the Arctic regions and the deeper ocean waters. The precise date of world peak oil production is still subject to debate, but oil remains a finite earth resource. Opinions continue to differ, but all place the peak sometime early this century, and this seems most likely to be correct. Most people living today will see the peak arrive and witness the beginning of the historic changes that diminished oil supplies will bring to civilization we know today. The changes will be far more profound and far-reaching than most people realize. Peak oil production will be a major event in world history. Exact peak date irrelevant. The precise date of the peak of world oil production, however, is an irrelevant academic exercise, since the true peak will be known only in retrospect after several years of well-documented declining production. The important fact is that oil production will inevitably peak and then decline. Campbell, in several published studies, has emphasized the end of hydrocarbon man, relating not only to oil, but natural gas and coal, calling it a turning point for mankind. The oil interval, unlike some parts of human history, can never be repeated. It is a one-time-only event, and the world must move on to a new energy paradigm and make myriad adjustments accordingly. Basic changes and current world oil industry trends. Probably the most important change has been the rise of the national government-owned, or NOCs, oil companies, and the corresponding decline in the international oil influence of the investor-owned companies, the IOCs. This change dates back to a time when the several waves of oil company nationalization took place. Since that time, the NOCs have been gaining in importance as they are increasingly able to run their own oil industries. Current NOCs control about 90% of world oil reserves. The combined reserves of ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, ConocoPhillips, Chevron, and Total, a French company, are less than one quarter of the reserves Saudi Arabia claims. Wow. So current NOCs, that's national controlled, government owned, is 90% of all world oil reserves. The combined reserves of ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, ConocoPhillips, Chevron, and Total, a French company, are less than one quarter of the reserves Saudi Arabia claims. In countries where IOCs can still operate because they have the technology and the capital, i.e. Angola, Algeria, and Nigeria, the host nations are demanding so much of the profits that some IOCs have decided that they can no longer operate there. ExxonMobil abandoned the Orinoco heavy oil deposits when Venezuela abruptly raised taxes from 1% to 16%. Orinoco. It takes as long as 10 years from the time of winning bids, all proceeds going to a country of ownership, regardless of whether oil is found or not, to reach any oil production. Corporate plans have to be made on the basis of the initial financial agreements. Countries may, and increasingly do, simply tear up existing contracts and insist on new ones. One country did so after a company had spent millions of dollars in exploration and finally discovered oil. The host country then canceled the original contract. When asked about this action, the country told the company that, quote, "We gave you the lease at the original agreed cost because we didn't expect you to find any oil," unquote. In another country, before leases were issued, an IOC spent 2 years and millions of dollars determining which of the lease blocks being offered had the best prospects. When they told the host country they would take the leases, the NOC of the host company took the leases for itself instead. So the IOC did all of the work and the NOC took all of the benefit. If IOCs are to continue finding oil after their home country has been thoroughly explored, as the onshore United States has been, for example, they must explore new areas and depend on other countries for their survival as oil companies. This has also pushed drilling offshore, sometimes to depths down to 10,000 feet, making these ventures very costly. Major oil companies in the United States have moved both abroad and into the Gulf of Mexico, drilling as far as 200 miles offshore, risking hurricanes and other harsh conditions. Offshore drilling platforms are leased, and the daily lease cost for one drill rig is as high as $700,000. Wow. Offshore drilling platforms are leased, and the daily lease cost for one drill rig is as high as $700,000. A company has to find a lot of oil to justify such costs, and at best, the oil is very expensive to recover. In 2011, the largest investor-owned companies, ExxonMobil, Royal Dutch Shell, commonly referred to as Shell, and BP, reported higher profits than they produced, but they produced less oil from fields around the world. Their decline in production was 7%. The results highlighted a growing problem. New petroleum supplies are increasingly hard to find, and they cost more to find and develop. A decade ago, bringing in an oil well costs about $20 for every barrel produced. The cost now is estimated to be $50 to $60 per barrel. Cost is calculated on the basis of exploration and subsequent field development expenses amortized over the life of the field and oil produced. For a time, these increased costs can be offset by price increases. Eventually, oil companies will have to operate on a diminished production basis that cannot be offset by price increases. Return on oil investment compared with other industries. Historic returns on the money invested in U.S. investor-owned oil companies has been in the mid-range of all industries. The greatest returns have been from tobacco and liquor companies, which do not have to lease drilling platforms, have their contracts torn up by foreign governments, or be subject to violent offshore hurricane damage with related high insurance costs. Ironically, oil companies supply a very useful commodity of daily benefit to millions, whereas tobacco and alcohol use damages health and results in huge medical costs to users and many others. The rising cost of oil exploration in increasingly difficult situations is illustrated by Petrobras, a Brazilian national oil company, with its world-class oil discoveries in the offshore Campos and Santos basins. Petrobras ranks fifth among New York Stock Exchange, NYSE, listed world oil producers, but ranks first in capital investment, $43.5 billion for the most recent 12 months on record. But its return on investment ranks last. Worldwide, the oil industry is spending more to find each barrel of oil, and oil and gasoline prices trend upward accordingly. Petroleum industry's use of technology. No other industry employs the magnitude and diversity of technology that petroleum does through its exploration, production, and refining. The scope of technology used includes satellites for positioning offshore drilling platforms and for transmitting data from remote drilling locations to regional offices to get a vision of the internal structure of the earth. completing ocean floor oil wells with robots laying and repairing thousands of miles of ocean floor pipelines to facilitate gathering crude oil and natural gas from wells to central locations is now possible. And there is much more. In refining, the chemistry and physics complexes involved are enormous. Lengths to which oil industry now goes to reach oil. There have been many advances in oil exploration and extraction. One has been the increased distance to which multiple drilling bits can now be steered to reach an oil reservoir from a single drilling platform. The most recent record is 7.6 miles. This extended drilling, reach drilling, ERD, means that the footprint of oil production is greatly reduced, as ERD can now reach an area of as much as 4.4 square miles, not replacing their reserves. Because they now have fewer quality exploration opportunities, most major IOCs are not replacing their production with new discoveries. In 2008, for example, ConocoPhillips only replaced one out of every four barrels of oil they produced or extracted. The inevitable ultimate depletion of oil reserves is well recognized by IOCs and NOCs. Both are considering long-term alternatives in the energy future. BP and Chinese companies are investing in biofuels. Abu Dhabi Future Energy Company has invested in wind power. Solar energy is being explored by several companies. For this alternative, Saudi Arabia could be a major producer. At one time, when IOCs were dominant in production, they also set the price of oil. Now, the free market and OPEC's influence over production combine to determine the world oil price. IOCs have no control over pricing because of their diminished role in production and resource ownership. Still, Congress and other politicians hold hearings and investigations to take to task U.S. investor-owned oil companies in response to price increases. Many journalists, cartoonists, and now bloggers deprecatingly call the IOCs big oil, but it is really little oil. If Congress or commentators truly wish to show concern for the American public, they need to get this right. At one time, the U.S. Congress did vote to sue OPEC over high oil prices. Nothing has been heard of it since, and it is doubtful that OPEC was ever concerned. Oil production, some call it extraction, yeah, like William Catton, has exceeded the volume of oil discoveries since 1981, now by a factor of four. Say that again. Oil production, or extraction, has exceeded the volume of oil discoveries since 1981, now by a factor of four. Around the world, the 31 billion barrels of oil consumed each year are not replaced with discovery, even with the combined exploration totals of the NOCs and the IOCs. Big fields, which contain most of the oil, are not being found as they were previously. Figure 9-11. The International Energy Agency has projected that U.S. oil consumption will continue to increase and will reach 27.6 million barrels a day in 2030. However, since it is very unlikely that the peak of world oil conventional oil production will be later than 2010, all projections of increased consumption after that time are questionable. Some countries may outbid others for the remaining world oil supplies and therefore increase their oil consumption, but the total amount of oil available will be lower and total consumption will also be lower. By mid-century, world oil production may be down from its peak by at least half, perhaps more. At an energy conference in Houston in 1999, Mike Bolin, then chairman and CEO of ARCO, made this observation, quote, "We've embarked on the last days of the age of oil. Nations of the world are striving to modernize, will make choices different from the ones we have made. They will have to. And even today's industrial powers will shift energy use patterns. So I believe it's time to prepare ourselves for the new look of the energy industry of the 21st century." Unquote. We have been consuming oil at an unsustainable exponential rate. As a widely used advertisement from Chevron says, quote, It took us 125 years to use the first trillion barrels of oil. We'll use the next trillion in 30 years. Say it again. It took us 125 years to use the first trillion barrels of oil. We'll use the next trillion in 30. That said, how the new oil paradigm of higher oil prices, horizontal drilling, and shale fracking will alter the oil industry in the next several decades is unknown, but may be significant. An oil reserves, oil industry, and geopolitical game changer? In the next chapter, I discuss the newly utilized technology of drilling vertically to a target shale formation and then drilling horizontally and hydraulic fracturing, hydrofracking or just fracking, the shale with chemically treated water and sand greatly increases the amount of gas ultimately recovered. Experience has shown that using this technology may also recover oil from shales. These strata were previously regarded only as oil source beds, not producible oil reserves. Combined with the rise in the price of oil, likely to remain at $80 a barrel or higher, editor's note, it's now at $30 a barrel in early 2016, oil is now being economically recovered using this technology directly from some shales. The volume of shale strata around the world is enormous, but there are also great unknowns. Still to be discovered in many areas is whether the shales have been buried deeply enough and long enough over geologic time to have reached the temperature, the oil window at which oil is formed. If the shales are not yet mature, the organic material is still kerogen, the precursor of oil, as is the case in the misnamed oil shale strata, quote-unquote, which actually have no oil. Shale oil and oil shale, the distinction. At this point, we should make the distinction between shale oil and oil shale. It is easy to be confused. Oil from shale oil, comes from shale containing oil that has not yet migrated into conventional oil reserve rocks, reservoir rocks, and in fact might never have done so if reservoir rocks are not reachable by oil migration. It is true oil. Oil shale has no oil. It contains kerogen that has not yet heated to the temperature of the oil window when it would become oil. Shales which have gone through the oil window differ in the amount of oil they may contain. Some have very little. Individual shales may also have sweet spots subject to economic exploitation. Other areas where the oil content is lower may not be economic to drill. There are environmental impacts from the amount of water needed by each well, 5 to 6 million gallons, and from the subsequent disposal of the recovered water containing chemicals used to thicken the water to enable it to carry sand farther into the formation to hold up open the fractures. Obtaining enough suitable sand for fracking operations is a problem in many locations. Bowing to environmental concerns, France, Germany, South Africa, and in the U.S., New Jersey, New York, Maryland, and some other states have imposed temporary or permanent bans on fracking. But other states and many countries are beginning to use the technology. It provides income, employment, a welcome energy source, and possibly revenue from exporting oil and gas. Horizontal drilling and fracking of shales are being used worldwide to develop fossil fuel resources previously thought unavailable. China is moving fast to study its shales, which are numerous and widespread. Canada has several good prospects, some of which are already test drilled and proven. With a large number of shale deposits in the United States and abroad, the frontiers of exploration have been greatly enlarged. Shale deposits may have large production potential not earlier recognized. Broadly interpreted, there are 600 sedimentary basins in the world. Evaluating all these prospects will take many years, so the amount of oil and gas that can be produced from these basins is unknown today. Exploitation of these resources may well result in two peaks rather than one oil production peak. The first is the peak, probably already passed, of oil recovered from conventional reservoirs, usually sandstones or fractured or vulgar limestones. The second peak may come from conventional oil production with the added increment from oil from shale. A peak made independently by shale oil alone is possible, but not likely. key to economically recovering both oil and gas using the hydrofracking technology is the energy profit ratio, also termed energy recovered on energy invested, or EROEI. Because the technology is new, it is premature to make a study, but eventually it will be done to give an overall view of the work of the worth of the technology. The energy profit ratio for shale oil is likely to be far less than for conventional oil now estimated to be about 15 to 1. This ratio is declining as more costly oil is being produced in more difficult environments like deep water and Arctic regions. Also, shales differ from one another in several respects, and some may require refracking to maintain production. The length of time significant shale oil production will last has not yet been established. Some shales can yield oil steadily for an extended period, but at a very slow rate. Both shale oil and gas production may be extended for many years. The story of the oil industry is still unfolding. The last chapter is not yet clearly in sight. The period of the oil interval and gas production may be longer and geographically more widespread than we originally thought. The potential geopolitical implications of these recent developments are great. The influence that OPEC has had on world oil prices and on international political alignments to accommodate the need for OPEC oil may diminish as other regions become important in petroleum production from shale. Extending the economic availability of oil and gas may also delay the development of alternative energy sources. Delay, but not eliminate their ultimate need. Importance of fracking for the United States. A number of enthusiastic statements have been made about the possibility that fracking will free the United States from dependency on imported oil. A more realistic geological and engineering assessment suggests that the production of oil from shale by fracking is likely to reduce, but certainly not eliminate, the need for imported oil. Longer term, the U.S. and many other countries will still depend on the Gulf countries, where the gift of oil from Allah will be the last remaining source. Oil still a finite resource. Whatever period of time oil from shale adds to the length of the oil interval, it does not negate the fact that oil from whatever source is finite. Its inevitable decline in production to the point of essential exhaustion will cause a major transformation of economies and societies from what they are today. It almost certainly will mean a reduction in population that our petroleum-based oil and gas agricultural systems now support. For a time, additional oil and gas supplies may have the effect of supporting an even larger population, making the eventual but inevitable population reduction problem even more severe. It is frequently said that we have sufficient oil left for 40 years at the current rate of production, but the current rate probably cannot be maintained. Furthermore, oil production does not proceed at a fixed rate of 40 years and then drop off to zero. Production curves rise from zero to a peak and then decline back to essentially zero. Some oil will be produced for many more years, but there will be less and it will cost more. Oil will be used only for higher end value users. Editor's note, what's also not factored in here is the agreement at COP21 in Paris that all the countries of the world have agreed to basically move to a completely non-fossil fuel energy sources by 2050, if not sooner, and to keep temperature down. So the whole climate change issue and how fast we can get off oil and how fast the market drives us to do that will be a huge factor, and that's not factored into this book here. The extravagant ways in which we have used oil have within them the seeds of oil's ultimate demise. The decline of world oil production will sort out excesses and pare down waste. A post-oil energy paradigm will emerge, but for many uses, there is no adequate satisfactory substitute for oil. A fundamental concern is whether or not the absence of oil can be met by alternative energy sources in amounts necessary to prevent an energy supply gap somewhere between now and 2030. In 2007, a comprehensive report on this issue, Facing the Hard Truths About Energy, a comprehensive view of 2030 of global oil and gas, was issued by the National Petroleum Council, an industry advisory group comprised of more than 500 members. The report was requested by the U.S. Department of Energy. It is a detailed and exhaustive study whose principal conclusion is, quote, "There is no single easy solution to the global challenges ahead," unquote, and that all available energy sources must be developed and drawn upon to reach 2030 without a severe dislocation of the world economies due to insufficient energy supplies. Colin Campbell and Jean Lahaye, in several books and many articles and lectures, have been far ahead of this issue, trying to inform the public of the looming changes in world oil supplies. A decade ago, their article in Scientific American, 1998, was titled "The End of Cheap Oil." The same title was on the 2004 cover article in National Geographic. The late Matthew Simmons, in several articles, lectures, and media presentations, greatly added to efforts to inform public understanding of oil supply issues. The oil market has been increasingly volatile as the margin between supply and demand for oil has narrowed. A slight change in either element results in wide price swings, but low prices are only temporary. Inevitably, the geological limits of the oil supply dictate that prices will go up. Other resources then will shape the future, just as oil has for a century and a half. Quote from Tim Appelizer, The End of Cheap Oil, National Geographic, June 2004. Quote, "Humanity's way of life is on a collision course with geology, with the stark fact that the Earth holds a finite supply of oil. The flood of crude from fields around the world will ultimately top out, then dwindle." Historical note, the oilman's barrel. The standard measurement for crude oil is the barrel, which contains 42 U.S. gallons at 60 degrees Fahrenheit. The origin of this measurement has been widely researched and debated. The most comprehensive study of the origin of the barrel is the 122-page volume in 1958 by Robert B. Hardwick, University of Oklahoma Press. A brief summary of some ideas on the origin of the barrel is given in a note on page 788 of Daniel Yergin's The Prize, 1991. The exact origin of this measurement appears to be lost in history, but the more commonly accepted ideas are cited here. When crude oil was first produced commercially in Pennsylvania, whatever containers handy were used, like those used for wine, beer, whiskey, cider, and other liquids. The need for a standard measurement soon became apparent to establish an oil trade. The tierce, T-I-E-R-C-E, was a defined wine measurement in early use in Britain, as was the herring barrel and a barrel for spruce beer. These were 42-gallon containers. These barrels may have become the standard oil field measurement because they were in common use in the United States. They were very carefully made tight containers so that they would also hold oil very well. The Oil and Gas Journal of April 15, 1921, reported that in 1864-65, the first standard barrel was made by Samuel Van Sickle at Miller's Farm near Titusville, Pennsylvania. It had a 42-gallon capacity. The size fixed in that year, in the year 1461 in England, for the herring barrel during the reign of Edward IV. Van Sickle specified the size of the staves to be used and made an honest 42-gallon barrel. Almost immediately, he gained practically a monopoly on the business, and the odd-sized barrels gradually disappeared. Another possible origin stems from the fact that the lack of a standard measure caused confusion, friction, and short tempers. In 1866, a group of oil producers got together in West Virginia and issued a proclamation stating that they would sell oil only by the gallon, but that the allowance of 2 gallons for leakage and impurities would be made for every 40 gallons, thus making a total of 42 gallons. From this, the standard 42-gallon barrel emerged, and 10 years later, a council of producers formally adopted the 42-gallon barrel as the standard measure. These are two of the more likely possibilities for the origin of the oilman's barrel. There are several others. There's also a related question of how the abbreviation BBL came to be used for oil barrel, because there is no second B in the word barrel. Oil historian Paul Giddings, in his book Standard Oil Company, 1955, writes that kerosene was shipped in blue-painted barrels and gasoline was shipped in red-painted barrels. The term RBL was used to designate the red gasoline barrel, and BBL indicated the kerosene blue barrel. The BBL symbol was the designation most commonly seen in refinery shipment records and ultimately became the general symbol for all oils in barrels. Note, kerosene is the petroleum industry spelling. Kerosene is the more common spelling. Oh, that's interesting. K-E-R-O-S-I-N-E is the petroleum, and K-E-R-O-S-E-N-E is the more common spelling. Conversion equivalence. The theoretical 42-gallon barrel of crude oil is equivalent in energy to 5,800,000 British thermal units, BTUs. 5,614 cubic feet of natural gas, or 0.22 short ton, that's short ton is 2,000 pounds, of bituminous coal. Various crude oils differ in density, but the average barrel of crude weighs about 310 pounds. Some oil terms and numbers. The oil industry uses a host of technical terms and jargon, most of which do not get into the general media. For example, DST means drill stem test. Here are some the reader may encounter. Those related to natural gas are included at the end of chapter 10. BOE is barrels of oil equivalent, adding natural gas to total oil estimate with 6,000 cubic feet of gas taken to equal one barrel of oil. BPD is barrels per day. Upstream, exploration and production operations. Downstream, refining, transportation, and marketing operations. ENP, that's exploration and production. BPPD, that's 1,000 barrels per day. MMBPD, million barrels per day. And GB is international abbreviation for billion barrels, gigabarrels. Sometimes capital M is used either for 1,000 or million, so sometimes million may be written either as M or MM. It can be a bit confusing, and one has to know to a certain degree in what scale and in what context the discussion is being conducted. In general literature, the lowercase m is widely used for million.